O ye who tread the narrow way by Tophet flare to Judgment Day, be gentle when the heathen pray to Buddha at Kamakura. Buddha at Kamakura. He sat, in defiance of municipal orders, astride the Gunzumzama on her brick platform opposite the old Ayabgar, the Wonder House, as the natives called the Lahore Museum. Who hold Zumzama, that fire-breathing dragon, hold the Punjab, for the great green bronze piece is always first of the conqueror's loot. There was some justification for Kim. He had kicked Lala Dinaneth's boy off the trunnion since the English held the Punjab and Kim was English. Though he was burned black as any native, though he spoke the vernacular by preference, and his mother tongue in a clipped uncertain sing-song, though he consorted on terms of perfect equality with the small boys of the bazaar, Kim was white, a poor white of the very poorest. The half-caste woman who looked after him, she smoked opium, and pretended to keep a second-hand furniture shop by the square where the cheap cabs wait, told the missionaries that she was Kim's mother's sister, but his mother had been nursery maid in a colonel's family and had married Kimball O'Hara, a young color sergeant of the Mavericks, an Irish regiment. He afterwards took a post on the Sindh, Punjab, and Delhi Railway, and his regiment went home without him. The wife died of cholera in Ferzepuri, and O'Hara fell to drink and loafing up and down the line with a keen-eyed three-year-old baby. Societies and chaplains, anxious for the child, tried to catch him, but O'Hara drifted away, till he came across the woman who took opium and learned the taste from her, and died as poor whites die in India. His estate at death consisted of three papers, one he called a single quotenny varietor because those words were written below his signature Therian, and another his clearance certificate. The third was Kim's birth certificate. Those things, he was used to say, in his glorious opium hours, would yet make little Kimball a man. On no account was Kim to part with them, for they belonged to a great piece of magic, such magic as men practiced over yonder behind the museum, in the big blue and white J. Duggar, the Magic House, as we name the Masonic Lodge. It would, he said, all come right some day, and Kim's horn would be exalted between pillars, monstrous pillars of beauty and strength. The colonel himself, riding on a horse, at the head of the finest regiment in the world, would attend to Kim, little Kim that should have been better off than his father. 900 first-class devils, whose god was a red bull on a green field, would attend to Kim, if they had not forgotten O'Hara, poor O'Hara that was gang foreman on the Ferzepuri line. Then he would weep bitterly in the broken rush chair on the veranda. So it came about after his death that the woman sewed parchment, paper, and birth certificate into a leather amulet case which she strung round Kim's neck. "And some day," she said, confusedly remembering O'Hara's prophecies, "there will come for you a great red bull on a green field, and the colonel riding on his tall horse, yes, and dropping into English dash 900 devils." Said Kim, "he shall remember. A red bull and a colonel on a horse will come, but first, my father said, will come the two men making ready the ground for these matters. That is how my father said they always did, and it is always so when men work magic." If the woman had sent Kim up to the local J. Duggar with those papers, he would, of course, have been taken over by the provincial lodge, and sent to the Masonic orphanage in the hills, but what she had heard of magic she distrusted. Kim, too, held views of his own. As he reached the years of indiscretion, he learned to avoid missionaries and white men of serious aspect who asked who he was, and what he did. For Kim did nothing with an immense success. True, he knew the wonderful walled city of Lahore from the Delhi gate to the outer Fordlich, was hand in glove with men who led lives stranger than anything Harun al-Rashid dreamed of, and he lived in a life wild as that of the Arabian Nights, but missionaries and secretaries of charitable societies could not see the beauty of it. His nickname through the wards was Little Friend of All the World, and very often, being lithe and inconspicuous, he executed commissions by night on the crowded house eatops for sleek and shiny young men of fashion. It was intrigue, dash of course he knew that much, as he had known all evil since he could speak, dash but what he loved was the game for its own sake, the stealthy prowl through the dark gullies and lanes, the crawl up a water pipe, the sights and sounds of the women's world on the flat roofs, and the headlong flight from house eatop to house eatop under cover of the hot dark. Then there were holy men, ash-smeared fakirs by their brick shrines under the trees at the riverside, with whom he was quite familiar, greeting them as they returned from begging tours, and, when no one was by, eating from the same dish. The woman who looked after him insisted with tears that he should wear European clothes, trousers, a shirt and a battered hat. Kim found it easier to slip into Hindu or Mohammedan garb when engaged on certain businesses. One of the young men of fashion, he who was found dead at the bottom of a well on the night of the earthquake, had once given him a complete suit of Hindu kit, the costume of a low-case street boy, and Kim stored it in a secret place under some box in Neela Ram's timber yard, beyond the Punjab High Court, where the fragrant deodar logs lie seasoning after they have driven down the Ravi. When there was business or frolic,